Welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy, pluralism, and peace. My name is Omar Sadr, a senior research scholar at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Governance and Markets. In this episode, I chat with Julian Mueller, who is a senior research associate at the Department of Philosophy at the University of Hamburg, Germany. I discuss the details of his recent book titled Political Pluralism, Disagreement, and Justice, The Case for Polycentric Democracy. In this conversation, we try to discuss how can we deal with pluralism and how polycentric mechanisms present a framework for adjudicating disagreements and diversity. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Julian, welcome to Negotiating Ideas.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
As I said earlier, I enjoyed reading your book. This is fascinating and terrific. The issues related to polycentric democracy and how can we adjudicate disagreements and diversities, something that the modern world is struggling with. And we have been facing crisis, polarization. So I'm really interested to talk about all of those. But at the beginning, tell me about yourself. And your book, how did you come up with this idea?
So as you said, right, I'm a research associate at the University of Hamburg. And I guess from very early age on, I've been interested in religion and in philosophy. And I've read widely, even when I was like very young, Buddhist texts, Islamic texts, various Christian texts, and engaged in a lot of different political philosophies. And one thing that always struck me is that if you look throughout the ages, right, there's so many conceptions of justice, so many conceptions of what the final good is that we should pursue, right? And later I found myself in philosophy as a serious academic, and I always like was wondering on some meta level, right, that we have like so many philosophers that try to spell out what the ideal of justice is, what the perfect institutions of justice are, right? And sometimes, you know, you have like colleagues, you know, in one department, and one says A and one says B and the other one says C, right? And I thought, you know, the main question should not be, you know, like, what is justice, right? But rather, how can we live in a world where we like deeply disagree about norms and facts, right? And I think if you really like take this to be the starting point of political philosophy, then you are necessarily drawn to liberalism, because liberalism is one of the few like systems of thought that takes fundamental disagreements about norms and facts as its starting point, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so do you want me to talk more about the book, or should we leave it at this?
But maybe we can discuss about book also. But here I have a point to you. So you said in a state of justice, which is presumed by some of the liberal theorists as an end goal, or as what is the good to be pursued. You suggest that we should think about how can we reshuffle or rethink about disagreements that we have in our society. So now I recall one of the sentences in your book, which you say, we might imagine, I quote you, we might imagine a world in which disagreements between reasonable people will motivate the involved parties to abstain from all political actions until they reach a general consensus through deliberation. So it seems that you at some point agree that we have to reach a consensus over whatever sort of disagreements do we have. So now the question that I want to pose you is, what is your understanding of modus vivendi? Because different scholars define modus vivendi quite differently. For example, John Gray's modus vivendi not necessarily subscribe to a form of consensus. So the question is it necessary? We have to reach a kind of consensus, or what is your understanding of modus vivendi?
Well, if I remember correctly, the paragraph says, you know, we might imagine that, right? But this will never happen, right? The world will never stand still until philosophers and religious scholars have agreed on a final conception of justice, right? So given that we will never agree on what justice requires, right? We need to find a political order, right? That somehow that we can live in until we have found, you know, what justice requires.
Right. Okay.
But the main point is actually to say, and that's a little bit, that's the actual, you know, core idea of the book, is that I don't believe that we can find what justice requires as a theoretic. We cannot find an answer to the question of what justice requires from the armchair, right? I think to really find out what justice requires, we need to have a set of experiments in living, right? So I think that this very idea that philosophy pursues, namely that, you know, that we can sit in our armchairs and theorize from first principle of what justice requires and what institutions best implement justice. I think this is an old, like, Platonic ideal, and I don't subscribe to it, right? I think what institutions best satisfy justice can only be basically found out by experiments. And also on a conceptual level, I think to really make progress when thinking about justice, we also need some ideas that we can only discover through real-world experiments, right?
Mm, that's right. That's right. So now you discuss about types of disagreements that we have, and to try to theorize a notion of disagreements, categorizing it between lazy, shallow, and deep disagreements. Mm. This is really fascinating. So I want you to talk about all of those also. But also when I was reading that, I was recalled of the same form of vocabulary used by William Connolly. He has this concept of deep pluralism, shallow pluralism. And by shallow pluralism, he refers to forms of secularism which is influenced by the Kantian idea, basically the liberals. Well, liberalism also argues that it is a way out towards adjudicating moral disputes, but it has certain presumptions which are a priori. How do you adjust yourself when you talk about disagreements, shallow or deep, contrary to William Connolly's idea of deep pluralism that he mentions? Because deep pluralism that he mentions to some point comes very close to some critical democratic theorists like Chantal, mm-hmm. who argues that there will never be a consensus. It's always about antagonism, which happens in society, and that's why they suggest a form of agonistic democracy, which acknowledges differences and also acknowledges antagonism and acknowledges exclusions, which may happen in any way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So let me just like spell out what I mean by these three concepts, right?
Yeah.
So first of all, let's start with lazy disagreements. Lazy disagreements are basically disagreements that only occur because, you know, some person has not deeply taken into consideration all the evidence that there is already, right? And a lot of, I think, our disagreements in the public sphere are lazy, right? Because most people don't have enough time or just simply are not interested in politics and studying up on history or economics. And so they just blurt out opinions without having done their homework, right? And so a lot of the disagreements, and probably most of the disagreements that we find nowadays in the public sphere, are lazy, right?
Yeah.
So if all of us would do our homework, there would be less disagreement. Now there's also shallow disagreements. And shallow disagreements are disagreements where you have on each side a reasonable person and both have done their homework, but they disagree because the evidence to be considered is just simply inconclusive. And if we would do more policy experiments, more experiments in living, this disagreement would finally evaporate, right? And I assume that a lot of our disagreements, also in public policy, but maybe also in political philosophy, would evaporate if we would do more political experiments in living, right?
Yeah.
And I always like to give this example of the socialist calculation debate, right? So one of my first books, is on the economist and philosopher Ludwig von Mises, right? And in the 1920s, he already argued that socialism is non-viable. But he said socialism is not viable because just the internal functions of the economy of a socialistic state cannot be stabilized over the long term, right? And so he gave certain economic arguments for that. But it's interesting, right? So to consider that example, because I think in the long run, history proved him right. But it's not the arguments that Ludwig von Mises or Hayek provided, you know, that convinced people that socialism doesn't work, right?
Yeah.
It's the actual experience of socialism that convinces people that socialism doesn't work, right? I mean, socialism not in the sense of how socialism is used nowadays in the US, but socialism in a more technical sense, right?
Yeah.
Which means like collective ownership of the means of production. And so one of my points here is to say, well, reason is really a blunt knife, right? In the sense that reason alone is really not, you know, sharp enough to settle a lot of the disagreements that we really care about, right? And so so I think a lot of these disagreements that we have are shallow in that sense that if we would have more experience, if we would do more experiments, we could settle these disagreements, right? And these disagreements cannot be settled by argument. And even, and if I may add that, you know, even if the arguments would convince, you know, intellectuals, they will probably not convince political activists, because political activists, you know, they have a different intellectual trajectory, right?
Yeah.
They don't spend so much time on reading, but they need to focus all of their energy to, you know, find ways to publicize their agenda, right?
Yeah.
And these people will not reach by argument, but just by experience, right? And so the third concept is deep disagreements, and that's simply disagreements that will remain even if, in the hypothetical counterfactual, we would have done like all the experiments living that we could possibly imagine, right? But we can imagine, and that's cool to be about being a philosopher, right? We are allowed to do thought experiments. And so you can do the thought experiment, say, let's assume we have done all the experiments living that we care about, right?
Yeah.
And after that, we still disagree, right? Then this set of disagreements are the deep disagreements. And about the theorists that you mentioned, I'm unfortunately not very familiar with this work, so it's hard for me to draw the contrast. I'm very sorry.
No problem. But and then you, in your book, you try to encounter or juxtapose three branches of philosophies, the liberals, particularly John Rawls, you engage with, You engage with deliberative democratists, Thompson, for example, and Gottman. And then the last one is the political economy perspective, constitutionalists, constitutional democrats. So let's discuss some of these one by one. For example, your critique with respect to John Rawls, as many other pluralists critique Rawls, is that it has certain assumptions. For example, the wheel of ignorance considers human beings empty of all their characteristics, your identity, your assumptions, your morality, your ethics. And that's simply not possible. That's one. And then also, so John Rawls also presents, for the sake of agreeing on a common good or principle of justice, he considers wheel of ignorance something quite important. But when I read yours, you also suggest representative of comprehensive doctrines, which you abbreviations ROCD, as a jury, who, as a mechanism, this jury is your mechanism in order to look at all these alternative philosophies, liberalism or deliberative democrats, and at the end come up with a judgment, whether they fulfill modus vivendi or pluralism or not. Now, can I ask this question? What is the difference between your jury, your representative of comprehensive doctrines, with John Rawls' wheel of ignorance? In a sense, Rawls also tried to bring the jury who are staffed with knowledge, they are knowledgeable people, and it's, for both of you, it's hypothetical. It doesn't exist in real world. He's also suggesting something hypothetical. You're a representative of common doctrine is hypothetical. So how do you situate yourself quite different from Rawls in this perspective?
Very, very good. Let me maybe like start at a little bit more of a fundamental level, right? So I think first of all, we started our conversation by me pointing out that what's interesting about liberalism, or what draws me to it, is that the fundamental question for liberals is how to deal with reasonable disagreement, right? And so all these theories that I have picked, right, you named them, right, are what I call second order theories, right? Namely theories that take as a starting point that there is fundamental disagreement, and the, we want to solve these fundamental disagreements in a reasonable way, right?
Yeah.
And this is, for instance, very different from, let's say, what you're talking about in your book about like fundamentalist, Islamic fundamentalists, right? Because Islamic fundamentalists are, in some sense, you know, they are first order theories. They have a theory about what justice requires, what God wants, right? And so they're not concerned with the very fact that smart and reasonable people come to different conclusions, right? They are concerned with bringing their vision into fruition, right? While the theorist that I'm concerned with here, they take reasonable disagreement very seriously, right? So that's the difference between first order theory and second order theory, right? And now to your question, right? So in Rawls' original position, as you said, we abstract away from various markers of identity to come to an agreement with regards to principles of justice, right? While the hypothetical agreement or hypothetical contractual situation that I paint is really staffed by real people, right? So you could have like a representative of utilitarianism, a representative of, you know, some moderate Islamic religious faith. You can have a representative of libertarianism, right? And they can, they know all about their identity. They are just the people who they are, right? With all their history, with all their desires, with all their weaknesses, right? And so this is the set of representatives. It's basically us, right? Yep. But the subset of us that is reasonable, that is interested in justice, right? And not everybody is interested in justice. A lot of people are just interested, you know, to further the good of their family, of themselves, right? Egoists or people who are like really concerned with their family or their group. But in the thought experiment that I undertake, we have representatives of various faith and political philosophies, and they should come to a judgment on which kind of, you know, modus vivendi is the best one, right? From their own perspective, right?
Yeah. So don't you think Rawls is also exercising some sort of the same thing? Because Rawls is also, at the end of the day, a second-order theory.
And yes, I mean Rawls, as you know, right, I mean, changes his point of view or changes his stance considerably between his first major book, right, A Theory of Justice and Political Pluralism, right? And in Political Pluralism, political pluralism, but political liberalism, right? He's much more concerned with reasonable disagreement than he is in his first work, right?
So then let's move on to deliberative democrats. What's your main contention about them? How do you consider that they do not fulfill some sort of modus vivendi, which is acceptable for all these other representative of alternative theories? What are the main points that deliberatives fail to consider in order to present a framework of modus vivendi?
Thank you very much. I just published a paper in Episteme that really fleshes out that point. I think, like, for me, the major qualm, I mean, there's a number of disagreements that I have with them, but my major objection against deliberative democracy is that I think that their theory of how we make social progress is a bit too shallow, right? Because in deliberative democracy, the idea is basically that we together determine where we want to go as a society, right? And so this really presupposes that reason is very good at basically, you know, setting a certain goal, right? For us as a collective, and then going there, right? And if we look at how innovations actually are produced and diffuse through society, and there's a whole subset or there's a whole discipline in the social sciences that looks at how innovation diffuses, namely innovation diffusion studies, then we will see that innovation often comes from points where we didn't expect it, right? And innovative minds often, you know, need space, basically, for their need to have like some testing ground for their ideas in order to prove their value, right? Yeah. And so I think so in order for, you know, interesting new institute, I mean, we see that very clearly, right? In the market and in science. The market and science are structured in such a way that we do not first agree on a goal, and then every scientist and every participant of the market tries to implement, but we give a general structure in which every scientist can follow their own hunches. Yeah. Every entrepreneur can follow their own hunches, right? And once they have developed their theory or their product, right? They test it in the scientific community or on the market, right?
Yeah.
And I think for social innovation to occur, we also need to have that freedom, right? namely that like a city comes up with a new way of, you know, providing healthcare, a new way of providing social security, a new way of forming community, a new way of creating like integration, right? And it's only from these experiments that we can learn in the end, as Hayek said, what we truly want and what is truly better, right? Yeah. And that goes back to the thought that I mentioned earlier, that the knife, that reason is a blunt knife, right? Reason cannot tell us, you know, in advance of which experiments will go well and which experiments will show results that in the end, will satisfy us, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, but still, when I, for example, first read about deliberative democracy very early on from David Held on his book Models of Democracy, he differentiates between two categories of deliberatives. One is the impartialists, who believe that we can reach to a conclusion and there is no power relationship and any social relations. But on the other hand, there are those who are critique of impartialists, particularly Gottman and Thompson that you discuss in your book, according to David Held, is of those category of the second one. These are the ones who appreciate embeddedness of power in social relationships, but also assume that we can never probably reach to an agreement. So in terms of pluralism deep disagreements that you may say, they completely subscribe to the idea of deep disagreements, that there are possibilities that despite having all evidences, despite having the experiments, still we may not have. And then they suggest, let's appreciate that in certain circumstances, we have to just respect each other. Apart from respect, we cannot do it anything else. So I see here a difference. You consider Thompson and Gottman as the ones who does not fulfill the criteria of modus vivendi and deep disagreements. But on the other hand, there is an alternative interpretation of the same people who do not agree, because the spectrum of deliberative democrats is quite wide. You have scholars like Ben Habib, you know, who is influenced from Habermas. And then you have others who do not subscribe, for example, to a Habermasian notion of deliberative democracy.
My objection to deliberative democrats is not that they don't appreciate deep disagreement, right? But it's more my disagreement or objection is more about the institutions that they propose, right?
That's right. Okay. Yeah.
And so for me, the question is really, so I take justice very seriously, right? And the question for me is, given that we disagree so much about so many things, how can we nevertheless make progress towards justice, right? As a society, right? And I know in the camp of polycentricity, or scholars that are interested in the polycentric ideal, there are those that are more concerned about peace and stability, and there are those that are more concerned about progress towards justice, right? And I'm, as a philosopher, I'm more interested in progress towards justice, right? And in my view, you know, there's a lot of creativity in people, right? And creativity in young people, and they want to try new things, right? They want to experience life. They want to, you know, make sure that their vision somehow, you know, gets a fair chance.
Yeah.
And deliberative democracy, as we see it, right, or like democratic institutions, right? They are an institution in which, you know, in the end, nobody can try what he or she wants, right?
Yeah.
that it like basically doesn't make use of the inherent creativity of people, right? Because in democracy, we always need to bargain about, you know, what we will do next. Okay. And usually, if we bargain, you know, nobody gets what he wants, right?
Yeah.
Nobody can show off, nobody can try out, you know, the vision that she or he, like, holds dear, right? And I think instead of, you know, always agreeing on, like, you know, always, like, having this tug of war, right, where we in the end, you know, agree on something that we are both dissatisfied with, if it's possible, I think it's better if you do what you think is best and I do what I think is best. And the third person, or like third city in this example, right, does what it thinks it's best. And then let's see, you know, as Lessing said, right, we can then, you know, appreciate the goodness and the value of the ideas and the consequences of that very idea, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like just from an emotional point of view, you know, this democratic process where we always, you know, need to find like some minimal consensus, right? Consensus. It's just like hollowing out your soul somehow, right? It's not making good use of the creativity and of the spirit of people, right? And I think we need to change that.
And that's why you speak at the end of your book about the possibility or appreciating the possibility of exit. Democracy is not all about subscription or entry, but it's also having the option to exit. I will come back to that. But let me ask you one more question about the same thing, because at the end of your book, it seems that you also appreciate institutional solutions of some of the deliberatives, because quote unquote, you say a polycentric polity should be seen as a playground for deliberative democrats. So it seems that you do not reject everything that deliberative democrats say. You just want to change certain institutional mechanisms or arrangements for deliberative democrats. In order to, for example, because you fundamentally believe that polycentric system gives us the possibility of or freedom of experimenting with alternative policy solutions. So I think even deliberative democrats, some of them also subscribe to the same thing. For example, the concept of Nancy Fischer's concept of counterpublics, or what you also in the book mentions as a mini publics. So counterpublic is alternative publics against the mainstream. Those who are excluded, those who are marginalized, they bring alternative voices. So now again, I see some sort of similarities because you want to complement what deliberative democrats say. Apart from, of course, what you say that there's so much emphasis on rationality, emphasis that we can reach to a conclusion. But once we talk about mini-publics or counter-publics, there is a moment that you meet some of the deliberative democrats, isn't it?
Yes, you're completely right. So as you said, there's some deep, perhaps like deep conceptual disagreements, but obviously I'm deeply inspired by various schools of democratic thought. And there's also like two distinct places in my theory where this plays a huge role. First of all, right, so if you have like a lot of experiments in living, right, in a society, and that is like, for instance, by various cities and states having more rights to experiment, or like creating even new cities as we have done throughout the ages, I've just stopped like in the last 150 years, basically, in Europe, then we need to have a legal framework, right, that basically gives us some guidance of what kinds of experiments in living can be undertaken and what can't, right? We need to have a legal framework, because there can be also like something like a race to the bottom with regards to taxation and all of these things, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, like, we need to have a democratic decision about what are the limits to experimentations and how do we make sure that there's no, you know, race to the bottom with regards to taxation and all of these things, right? So we need to have deliberate democratic decisions about the framework, right? And then I think, you know, deliberative democrats should appreciate the idea of polycentric democracy, because I think, you know, what I said earlier about democracy, you know, hauling out the soul is also true for people who really are advocates of, you know, deeper forms of democracy, because there's, I mean, I'm a philosopher, and I mean, I study various new ideas, of course, of Democrats, of how they want to basically enhance democratic governance, right? And there's like things like autocracy, there's like various, you know, ideas of how to improve democratic decision making, right? And in a polycentric democracy, of course, we could like try out like much like a lot of these ideas that philosophers and political theorists and economists develop. We could try them out in practice, right? Because I'm like very open to the idea that one of these ideas that deliberative democrats have come up with, right, that maybe one of their ideas really, you know, comes closest to justice, right? Maybe they create like cities or network of cities that are really, you know, like from perspective of justice, just the places on earth where you really want to go most, right? But I think, you know, this cannot be decided by reason, right? That to decide that I need to go to that place and see how do the people behave? What is the general spirit of the people? What's the spirit of the city? You know, and so I think that this polycentric vision should really appeal to people who want to experiment with new ways of democratic decision making, right? And that's why this approach is not in direct opposition, but it's more like an invitation. Yeah?
Sure, but well, so still, if we agree that we should always keep the door of experimenting open through mechanisms of polycentric systems, but still, I think what a question remains to me is how can we reach to a certain agreement? Because even in your book, you do not neglect the fact that we have, as a society, we have to agree at least on a set of rights, you say. That is inevitable. A modern polycentric system, further, you argue, would certainly prescribe certain minimum requirements regarding social security, healthcare, public education. And this is exactly similar to the point of some of the scholars who are rethinking secularism in Europe, for example, because secularism is no more in most of the European societies, as and has never been, about total segregation of religious realm from political realm. And for example, scholars like Habermas talk about post-secular societies. So now, but the question is, how do we agree if we have, if it's not about lack of evidences or experimentation, about deep disagreements? Like, imagine I gave you example of Afghanistan, wherein, of course, this is not about second-order theories. It's about fundamentalist group like Taliban, who wants to impose a certain forms of morality, whatever they think it's good or justice. And that's the ultimate thing, and there's no further space for discussion or dialogue. So the end, they subscribe to certain form of violence to subjugate who disagree with them. Of course, your theory is about polycentric democracy. It's not it's not about non-democratic societies, but we talk about deep disagreements, and there is a requirement, for example, for public safety, education, health. We have to agree on certain things. How is that possible, probably, to you?
So I think maybe I'm naive, but I think the answer to that is bargaining, right? The nice thing about the idea of polycentric democracy and this model is, you know, everybody wants justice, right? Everybody really wants to know what justice is. So everybody but he is interested in seeing a lot of experiments to get closer to the idea of justice, to get closer to, you know, living in just societies, right? And they are open, because they are liberals in some sense, to the fact that they might be wrong, right? And that's a, like a fundamental idea in liberalism that will be, is what my new book will be about, is like the fundamental, one of the fundamental ideas of liberalism is this, I might be wrong. Maybe you are right about justice. Right. And so I have some reason, if I trust you that you are reasonable and that you're really, you know, sincere about seeking justice, that, that I let you try out what you think is best. Right. But that's not the case with fundamentalists, right? Yeah. Of any kind of stripes. Fundamentalists already know that they are right, right? Yeah. And so they also, you know, there's nothing to gain for them in your experiments, because they know that you're wrong and they are right. So, and so I think with fundamentalists, you can only deal in instrumental ways, right?
What do you mean by that?
So that means, you know, like try to do like, try to bargain with them, try to come up with Pareto improvements, right? And the cool thing about bargaining is often that we can find some kind of solution where both sides, you know, get a little bit more of what they want, right? I mean, I'm sure that, you know, also radical Talibans, you know, at some level, you know, have a problem with poverty, have a problem with killing, have a problem with, you know, lack of healthcare and all of these things, right? But we must be like very aware of the fact that we don't share a common ground, right?
Yeah.
In the sense of values, right? And insofar as people do not even cannot even conceive of the fact that they might be wrong, right? It's very, very hard for us to form like a true community which is built on equal respect, right? Because one needs to always remember that, you know, if you are with a fundamentalist and if you are in a modus vivendi with a fundamentalist, the only reason why you can live in a modus vivendi with a fundamentalist is because he is not strong enough yet to overpower you, and he will overpower you, right? If he's strong enough. So you must be always, you know, in a position where you can resist, right? And so I think one should not be naive in these things. So I think for these kind of problems, we need to look for bargaining solutions.
Bargain,
right?
Because
we cannot appeal to justice.
Yeah. So if in case, for example, that equilibrium that you suggested should exist between the fundamentalists on the other side and you on in this side, if that breaks, you say that there should be a kind of possibility that you prevent that situation. Can we imagine?
Can you say that again? I didn't get that question.
You suggested just now that fundamentalists most of the time overpower you. And hence that if they overpower you, that means that they will impose their assumptions.
If they get the chance, yes.
Yeah. So how to prevent that? That's a question. And in scenarios that they really overpower the others, for example, now in case of Taliban, they have really overpowered the rest of the society. I'm not talking dynamics between Taliban and the international community. Let's say dynamics only internally between the people of Afghanistan, though they are heterogeneous, and the Taliban. Now, I wonder if at some level, when people are overpowered by a fundamentalist group like Taliban, they have to resort to certain form of force against the fundamentalists in order to bring back some form of possibility for dialogue. Because at this moment, Taliban has that claim that they are the state, and hence they have a legitimate monopoly over use of force, and they use the force indiscriminately. And the people doesn't have any other option except to shut their mouths, or, for example, resort to alternative possibilities, and that may include force. Now, I just wonder if you also think that at this kind of scenarios, which might be very rare, use of force would be required or not?
So, you know, I think if I may say so, you know, we talk in Western societies a lot about diversity and difference of values, right? But it always strikes me as a little bit of, you know, a shallow conversation if we leave out history, right? I mean, a lot of liberal, you know, thinkers were burned at the stake for their ideas, right? For instance, one of the first Protestants, Jan Hus, right, whose experience and the history surrounding him is very instructive.
Yeah,
I think, right? So if you know history, you know that the reason why we live in liberalism nowadays is because a lot of people, you know, died for it because they thought it's valuable, you know? I mean, think about Germany right now. I'm a German citizen, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we were not convinced, you know, by argument that fascism is bad, right?
Yeah.
We were beaten down, right? By a superior force, right? And so the idea that you can, under all circumstances, you know, deliberate with somebody such that he allows you to have freedom, I think, you know, history speaks against that. To your to the example that you speak of, I mean, I don't know the power relations of Afghanistan well enough to you know, have an opinion, but just like to lay out the conceptual space, right? I mean, there's just two ways, right? And the one way is to hope for you know like a slowly changing, right, social dynamics throughout the ages, right, or throughout decades. And the other one is, violent resistance, of course. And which one is the better strategy depends on the factors on the ground and also on the spirit of the people, right? And I would never, ever, I think, want to be the judge for another man of what's the right thing to do, right? Because obviously this is what every individual needs to decide for himself or herself. And right now we see in Ukraine a very, very proud people, a very courageous people, right?
Yeah.
That fight for their independence, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's not a Hollywood movie. It's, I mean, I don't need to tell you that. You can tell me that better than I can, right? It's of course horror, right?
Yeah.
And we should be very, very grateful to our grandparents and grand-grandparents and grand-grand-grandparents who fought these bloody battles for us such that we can now enjoy the fruits of liberalism, right?
Yeah, that's
and
right.
That's why, of course, you know, knowing about history is so important, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, if I ask the very last questions to you, while reading your book at the beginning, it seems that you talk about an ideal type which doesn't exist in real world situation. You also say that most of the federal structures that we have at this moment may not necessarily confirm the principles of polycentrism because they do not allow, for the simple reason that they do not allow experimentation or change or exit, for example. But at the end, you also come up with a suggestion and solution, and that is your idea of free city approach that you borrow from the economist perspective of charter cities. I love you to speak about that also for our listeners. How can we idealize or implement a polycentric vision to a free city approach while our existing democratic arrangements may be very rigid and they do not allow new forms of policy experiments or alternatives. So what do you say about free cities?
Yeah, I mean, the basic question is, you know, what is the right... So if we think about really experimenting with justice, right, we need to think about like some kind of localities or that are, you know, like big enough to experiment with that, right? With new healthcare ideas, new ideas of democratic decision making. And I think the most likely place where we could do this is in cities, right? Because cities already often have a character. Sometimes the people in a city are more homogeneous, right? And so they have maybe an easier time to come to a decision with regards to progressive policies or just any kind of like interesting set of rules that might allow us to progress towards justice, right? And so the policy question is, of course, how does the constitution of a nation need to be amended such that cities have more space to experiment, right? And that's, of course, a legal question and a question for political scientists and economists, right? Because there's like various things to consider if you want to amend the constitution such that, you know, big cities can develop their character more fully, right? And I must say, you know, I as a philosopher, I'm just not qualified, you know, to come up with the exact rules that would need to be implemented such that cities have more space and more freedom to experiment, right? And that's, of course, where interdisciplinary research comes in, right? And research centers such as yours that really like think about the question of how can we have legal reform such that, you know, there's more space for experiments. Maybe like a final point to that, right? I mean, the constitution of various nations is, of course, very different, right?
Yeah.
So for each country or for each, you know, maybe even like the European Union, like association of countries, we need to have scholars that think for each country of how can we change the rules such that cities have more space to experiment, right? Perfect. Because there cannot be a one-size-fits-all solution because the regulatory change must be, of course, you know, in the context of the regulation that is already there. Yeah.
Okay. Well, with that note, I think we come to the end of this podcast, this episode. Truly thankful to your time, and I appreciate your discussion here. It was nice having you.
Thank you very much for having me. That was a great honor. And thank you very much.
Finally, to our audience, thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed this conversation between me and Julian Müller from Germany. And if you like the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast and share it with your friends. Looking forward to speaking to you the next session. Have a nice time.